Chapter 39. 2 days later, on the relief train, they reached Johannesburg. "I suppose we should report to somebody," Saul suggested, as the three of them stood together on the station platform beside the small pile of luggage they had been able to salvage from the train wreck. "You go and report if that's what you want," Sean answered him. "Me, I'm going to look around." "Oh, we've got no billets," Saul protested. "Follow your Uncle Sean." Johannesburg is an evil city, sired by greed out of a dam named Gold. But it has about it an air of gaiety, of brittle excitement and bustle. When you are away from it, you can hate it, but when you return, you are immediately reinfected, as Sean was now. He led them through the portals of the railway building into Elof Street and grinned as he looked up that well-remembered thoroughfare. It was crowded. The carriages jostled for position with the horse-drawn trams. On the sidewalks beneath the tall 3- and 4-storied buildings, the uniforms of a dozen different regiments set off the butterfly colours of the women's dresses. Sean paused on the station steps and lit a cigar. At that moment the sounds of carriage wheels and human voices were drowned by the plaintive wail of a mine hooter, and immediately others joined in signalling the noon. Automatically Sean reached for his pocket watch to check the time, and noticed the same general movement in the crowded street. He grinned again. Joburg hasn't changed much. Still the old habits, the same feeling about it. The mine dumps higher than he remembered them. A few new buildings. A little older and a little smarter. But still the same heartless bitch beneath it all. And there, on the corner of Commissioner Street, ornate as a wedding cake with its fancy ironwork and corniced roof, stood Candy's Hotel. With rifle and pack slung over each shoulder, Sean pushed his way through the press on the sidewalk, with Saul and Impijani in his wake. He reached the hotel and went in through the revolving glass doors. "Very grand," he looked about the lobby as he dumped his pack on the thick pile of the carpet. "Crystal chandeliers, velvet curtains roped with silver, palms and bronze urns, marble tables, fat plush chairs. Oh, what do you think, Saul? Shall we give this flophouse a try?" His voice carried across the lobby and stilled the murmuring of polite conversation. "Don't talk so loudly," Saul cautioned. A general officer in one of the plush chairs hoisted himself and slowly turned his head to train a monocled stare upon them, while his aide-de-camp leaned across and whispered, "Colonials." Sean winked at him and moved across to the reception desk. "Good afternoon, sir," the clerk regarded them frostily. "You have reservations for my chief of staff and myself?"
"What name, sir?"
"I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. We're travelling incognito," Sean told him seriously, and a helpless expression appeared on the man's face. Sean dropped his voice to conspiratory level. "Have you seen a man come in here carrying a bomb?"
"No."
The man's eyes glazed a little. No, sir, no, I haven't."
"Good," Sean appeared relieved. "In that case, we'll take the Victoria suite. Have our luggage sent up."
"General Caithness has the Victoria suite, sir." The clerk was becoming desperate.
"What?" Sean roared. "How dare you?"
Stuttering, the clerk backed away from him.
"Call the owner," ordered Sean.
"Yes, sir."
And the clerk disappeared through a door marked private.
"Have you gone mad?" Saul was fidgeting with embarrassment. "We can't afford to stay at this place. Let's get out of here."
Under the concentrated scrutiny of every guest in the lobby, he was very conscious of their grubby, travel-stained uniforms. Before Sean could answer, a woman came through the private doorway, a very lovely but very angry woman with eyes that blazed like the blue sapphires at her throat.
"I am Mrs. Rotenbach, the owner. You asked to see me."
Sean just smiled at her, and her anger withered slowly as she began to recognise him beneath the creased, ill-fitting tunic and without the beard.
"Do you still love me, Candy?"
"Sean?" She was still uncertain.
"Who else?"
"Sean!" And she came to him on the run. Half an hour later, General Caithness had been evicted, and Sean and Saul were settling comfortably into the Victoria suite. Freshly bathed, with only a towel around his waist, Sean lay back in his chair while the barber scraped away his 3-day growth of beard.
Some more champagne?
Candy had not taken her eyes off him for the last 10 minutes. Thanks.
She filled his glass, replaced it at his right hand, and then touched the thick muscles of his upper arm.
Still hard, she murmured.
You've kept ahead of the years.
Her fingers moved onto his chest.
Just a little grey here and there, but it suits you.
And then to the barber.
Haven't you finished yet?
One moment more, madam.
He again scissored along the line of Sean's temple, stood back and studied his masterpiece. Then, with modest pride, held the mirror for Sean's approval.
Excellent, thank you.
You may go now. See to the gentleman next door. Candy had waited long enough.
As the door closed behind the barber, she turned the key. Sean stood up from the chair, and they faced each other across the room.
My God, but you're big.
Her voice was husky, unashamedly hungry.
My God, but you're beautiful,
Sean answered her, and they moved slowly to meet in the centre of the floor.
Later they lay quietly while the darkness gathered in the room as evening fell. Then Candy moved her mouth across his shoulder, and the way a cat cleans its kittens, she began gently to lick the long red scratches upon his neck. When the room was truly dark, Candy lit one of the shaded gas lights and sent down for biscuits and a bottle of champagne. They sat together upon the rumpled bed and talked. At first, there was a shyness between them because of what they had done together. But soon it passed, and they sat up far into the night. Rare it is for a man to have a friend as well as a lover in one woman. But with Candy this was possible, and to her he released all those things that had been bottled and fermenting within him. He told her of Michael and the strange bond between them. He told her of Dirk and hinted at his misgivings for the boy. He spoke of the war and of what he would do when it finished. He told her of Lioncop and his wattle. But one thing he could not tell her. He could not speak of Ruth, or the man who was her husband.